Wine Emporium in Urbana. On Sunday, October 23rd from 7 to 10 p.m., the Corkscrew is hosting a concert at Farron's Pub and Eatery in Champaign to benefit local organizations dealing with displaced families from recent Gulf hurricanes. National indie recording artists Sam Shaber and Ann Heaton will perform. Information at 337-7704. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Illinois State Geological Survey's Centennial Lecture Series. The survey presents a public lecture at 8 p.m. on Thursday, October 13th, in the Lincoln Hall Theater, 802 South Wright Street on the U of I campus. Harrison Schmidt, the only geologist ever to walk on the moon, will present A Trip to the Moon and Beyond.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. The New Yorker magazine has put all of its back issues from February 1925 through February 2005 on DVD. 8 DVDs contain every word, cover, cartoon, illustration, and ad published in the magazine's 80 years. All you need to enjoy 8 decades of The New Yorker? Well, the asking price is $100. Then you need a computer with a DVD drive, an adequate operating system, and lots of time. The DVDs come with a companion book featuring the opening pages of some of the magazine's articles and an introduction written by David Remnick. Our guest this afternoon is the project director for the DVD collection, The Complete New Yorker. His name is Edward Claris. Ed Claris is the magazine's general counsel, responsible for all intellectual property, First Amendment, privacy, news gathering, licensing, publishing, and internet-related matters for the magazine, as well as for the magazine's editorial and e-commerce websites. Ed Claris is also an adjunct professor of law at Columbia University School of Law. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Ed Claris. Join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. Mr. Claris, thanks so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thanks for having me, Celeste.
Sure. When did this project become possible?
It was begun in December of 2003 when we shipped our 4,100 issues, two copies of each actually, down to Kansas City to have each page scanned. And at that point, once the pages were scanned, making them available, as you've described, on DVDs became possible.
Hmm. You know what this set made me wonder about? The library at the New Yorker. What's it like?
Well, we have one of the most unique libraries for a small institution like ours. We've had three librarians dedicated to reading each article after it's published and doing a little synopsis of the article in on little 3x5 cards, and they might do between 10 and 15 different 3x5 cards for each large article, each one describing a certain special element of the article itself. So you might have a piece about Muhammad Ali, so you'll have a card on Muhammad Ali, and then you'll have another card on prize fighting, and so on and so forth. So that's one thing that they do, but they also create scrapbooks for each one of our contributors or our major contributors. They'll cut out the article on a weekly basis and put it into his or her scrapbook. So someone like Charles Adams might have many scrapbooks.
Mm.
And others, people like Brendan Gill, who contributed from the mid-1930s to the 1960s, also has just a number of scrapbooks.
Yeah. It came to my mind last night when I was looking over the set and dipping into the DVDs that I was reminded of the movie Dusk Set with Katharine Hepburn and Joan Blondell and Spencer Tracy. And Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn clash over bringing a computer into their library, into her library there at Dusk Set. I wonder how do the librarians feel about the new technology?
They are thrilled with it, I have to say. First of all, the head librarian, John Michaud, was instrumental in helping me figure out how best to basically replicate the library experience that we've all always had here at The New Yorker for the public. And what we've done is we've tried to stay as close as we possibly could to that experience, but making it much easier to navigate.
Yeah.
So when you look at our database, you'll see what looks like a library card, but in digital form, where the author and the title and the page is on the top, and then a description of the article is in the middle, just really what it looks like on our cards. So the librarians are thrilled with this advance, and really are not going back to the cards these days and are using these instead.
Mm. Are scrapbooks still kept?
They are, yes. Scrapbooks are still kept, and we will, I think, continue to. But the library cards, the little synopsis cards on paper, are no longer kept, and we're now doing a little annotation of each article on the computer.
Mm.
Yeah, so, and that's happened over the course of the last number of years. It's not just because of this project.
Yeah. Now there are more than 4,000 issues here on these 8 DVDs, and as I understand it, over 500,000 pages. How do you navigate? Tell us a little bit more about how one navigates through this immense collection.
Well, okay, that's a good question. What we did was, you're not searching the words themselves on the pages themselves. Those are mirror images of exactly what the magazine was. So we took a photograph of every single page, and so we'll have cartoons and advertisements and the articles, and all laid out exactly as they originally appeared, covered by the cover. And they are static images. The way we navigate them is through this database that we created from the library index cards that I just described. And so when you search, you might search for John Cheever, and you'll put in Cheever in the author. There's an author search bar, and you'll get 141 or so stories that he wrote for The New Yorker, and they pop up immediately. They pop up as fiction, and when you click it, it'll give you a little description of the article. So you'll decide whether or not you actually want to read the article and go to it once you've looked at the little description of the story. So it takes what would otherwise be a 12,000 to 15,000 word story and puts it into 200 or 300 words, which makes it really much easier to know whether or not you want it. Mm. And then once you do, you just click a button, and the machine might say, please insert disk 4. And when you do, which is disk 4 is one of 8 discs that you have in your set, the article appears on the first page of the article that you've, or the story by John Cheever that you've asked for. But when you get to the article, you're actually inside the magazine itself. So say that story appeared at page 40. If you look at page 39, there might be a cartoon or an illustration or an advertisement. And if you look at page 41, you'll get to the next page of that story, and you'll be able to then navigate within the issue itself. Now, in 1940, we didn't have a table of contents to speak of. There was a little tiny box hidden, basically, on one page, but didn't tell you much. And what we've done is gone back and recreated the table of contents for every single issue, and you can look at it and decide and see what's in the issue, and you can see who wrote the Talk of the Town pieces in that issue. And then up through 1992, our Talk of the Town pieces were not signed. Mm-hmm. They were always anonymous. Same with the comment pieces, which were all part of Talk of the Town. We have in this collection revealed not just the author who wrote every Talk of the Town piece, but the editor who worked with that person, or the rewrite person. So you can navigate within that issue. Once you've gone to see the John Cheever story, you can sort of serendipitously search it. There's also what's called our cartoon browser, which we sort of took the hint from our readers and realized that many people like to, once they open a magazine, whether it's in the 1940s or now, they like to go to the cartoon.
Sure.
So what we did is we created a jumper. It goes from cartoon to cartoon in our issue, in one issue. So you can just sort of browse through that issue by cartoon, or you can click on the word cartoons and you'll see all the cartoonists in that issue and go to that person who you might be searching for or interested in.
Yeah.
So we've made that part of the navigation really easy. It's actually easier than picking up an old issue in paper.
Yeah.
Especially the old issues in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. The New Yorker was really fat. It was 200 pages a week. And lots of ads and tons of wonderful pieces under our esteemed editor, William Shawn. And so getting around those issues is tough, and it's hard to know exactly what you might want.
Boy, it's hard to keep up with it today.
Yeah.
You know, I got to ask you, do you look at the cartoons first?
Well, I actually look at the cartoons very first. We buy the cartoons every day. From the cartoonist, they come into the office, and our cartoon editor, Bob Mankoff, sits with them and decides which ones he's going to buy. And once they are purchased, in my job as the lawyer for the magazine, believe it or not, I actually read each cartoon. So I do look at them first. I have to admit, though, the magazine itself I end up reading before it's published, not after. So
yeah,
I don't have the luxury of
you're an insider.
That's true, but I sometimes miss just opening the magazine, not knowing what might be in it, and sort of flipping to the cartoons and deciding what to read. It's a wonderful weekly experience.
Yeah. Opening up the mailbox and finding it there is always a welcome. It's always a welcome sight. Now, as general counsel for the magazine, were you concerned about copyright issues raised by the publication of The Complete New Yorker?
Well, there was a question in the 1990s and early 2000s about the whether or not periodicals like the New Yorker or the New York Times or any newspaper or magazine could go back in time and republish or reuse their old issues in a new medium, in the electronic medium, without going back to all of their contributors. And there was a dispute, quite frankly, between freelancers who retained their own copyrights in their own works and periodicals during the late 90s and early 2000s. And the dispute was really about the use of by newspapers of articles in a database like Nexus. And I'm not sure if all of your listeners know what Nexus is, but it's a database that pulls out every article separately in a text format without any of the pictures or any of the ads or anything. It's just the article itself, all lumped together, all the articles lumped together, one after the other, or you can really just search for a particular topic, like, I don't know, Jackie Robinson, and you'll just get an article in the New York Times on him. And the New York Times argued at the time that, you know, by including all the articles, it was in effect the same exact newspaper. And the Supreme Court held, no, it really wasn't. If you pull apart each of the articles and you make them into a separate database, and they're not in context and not flippable, you don't feel like you're looking at the original in a new form, in a new medium, then it's really a new product. And if you're producing a new product, you need to have the right to do so, an explicit right by the contributors. And so there was a bit of concern through the industry. What are we going to do? How are we going to save our archives and make them available to the world without having to go back to tens of thousands of contributors, which was really an impossible task. So for a moment there, after the Supreme Court decision, places like the New York Times took down up to 140,000 articles in their archives, and they just didn't make them available. If they were under that sort of freelance exception, they wouldn't be included in the archives, in Nexus. And then what's happened, and the beauty of what the technology that I found here, we found here, is that we followed the Supreme Court's direction really closely, and the Supreme Court said, as long as you keep magazine or the newspaper, exactly as it originally appeared, in context, flippable, readable, back and forth through all of the different elements that you originally had, then you've used your copyright. And the copyright that they were referring to is the collective work copyright, the selection and arrangement of all of those individual contributions into what you find as the New Yorker on a weekly basis. It's not. It's more than the sum of its parts. You know, we put them together in a special way that flows beautifully, that looks right on the two-page spread that is the New Yorker. And we have a copyright in that collective work. And so what the Supreme Court has indicated is that as long as we use our copyright, our collective work copyright, then we're not. Even though an individual contribution might be in there, we're allowed to do that in a different medium. And this is a new medium. It's an electronic. And the way we view it is, this is microfilm in the 21st century. We're doing exactly what microfilm has always done, but making it much more beautiful to look at and much easier to access.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Ed Claris. He's the general counsel for the New Yorker magazine, and he's the project director for the DVD collection, The Complete New Yorker. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener, a caller in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah. Hi to you and Ed. I have a question that you may offer a legal explanation for the answer. Having a program where I have to keep flipping, inserting and deinserting discs over and over again, going nuts, I'm wondering if the provisions in your browser allow you to copy these DVDs onto your hard drive so that you don't have to do that?
For now, sir, we have just the discs. We're not really able to put it onto the hard drive and copy them over. It's a lot of data there. There's 55 gigabytes altogether of data. So
That's no issue anymore with the hard drives that we have.
Yeah, they're a big hard drive.
Is that a mechanical issue or a legal issue? Why you haven't done it so that, for convenience sake, put it that way?
Well, it's mechanical or legal. It's definitely not legal, although there's no legal requirement that we do it now. And mechanical, it was a decision based on the product that we decided to come out with, which was DVDs. We wanted to have people have similar experiences instead of and the experience that we wanted them to have was this one, although I know it can be sometimes frustrating to go disc to disc. The way I've viewed it is, when you're in a disc, you can set your program to just really look within that disc, and there's 500 issues in there. Oftentimes you can spend an eternity just on a disc.
Okay, the second question is, are the discs ordered chronologically?
They are, yes.
Okay, that'd help a lot. Well, you answered my question, and thank you very much. It's a real exciting new world we live in.
Good. I'm glad you're enjoying it.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Is there a way for folks to get a look at the collection before buying it?
Yes, actually. If you log on to www.archive.newyorker.com, we have a demonstration of the product, which is about a 10-minute long beautiful demonstration of exactly what it does and how it looks, so that people can get a good sense of it.
I've just barely dipped a toe into this collection, and the first thing I did was to look at the magazine's first issue, February 21st, 1925. The magazine has come a long way, hasn't it? Wow.
I know. It's like stepping back into a different time. That's one of the most interesting parts of this project I found was, it's not just reading something that was written in 1925, but when you open a piece of ephemera, a magazine from 1925, you really feel like you're stepping back in time. And it was quite a different animal at the time. It was first started by Harold Ross as kind of a light comic glib weekly that was really just for a certain type of Manhattanite. His idea was really just circulated as near home as possible. And it didn't quite take off all that quickly. I really didn't. It took until about 1928, 29 for him to really get what he wanted the New Yorker to be. And it took until then. There were moments there when the magazine almost closed because it was losing so much money. Mm. And then he turned it around, and it became the mix that he was able to find, the mix of reporting, fiction, cartoons, and the funnier, lighter pieces really took shape.
Yeah. James Thurber called it the outstanding flop of 1925. And then, but also, that you'll also learn in the introduction written by the magazine's current editor, David Remnick, he quotes Harold Ross commenting on the magazine after World War II, and Ross said, "I started to get out a light magazine that wouldn't concern itself with the weighty problems of the universe, and now look at me."
Right, and of course he's referring to the very well known Hiroshima piece by John Hersey and many other wonderful Second World War in depth pieces. Janet Flanner doing her reports from Germany, and this great reporting. So he had changed that magazine quite a bit by then.
Yeah, I want to share with listeners that in the companion book, where you kind of get a sense of some of the work that has appeared in the magazine over the years, there is the piece. There is the piece on the atomic bomb, and the editors of the New Yorker write to their readers. "The New Yorker this week devotes its entire editorial space to an article on the almost complete obliteration of a city by one atomic bomb and what happened to the people of that city." Was it the war, was it World War II that made the magazine grow up and in fact, become a national magazine?
I don't really know enough about when it became national. I think it was before that. It was in the late 30s, but I'm not positive of what the circulation looked like right around then, right mm-hmm. before the war and after. And also, there was a lot of very good reporting through the 1930s that is sometimes now forgotten. But, a person like A.J. Liebling and Brendan Gill, Joseph Mitchell was writing his wonderful story, his pieces about New York in the 1930s. W.H. Auden, James Thurber, they were all Philip Hamburger in the 1930s. So they were some real heavy hitters, and I can go on and on during that time. But then after the Second World War, shortly after that, that Harold Ross stepped down as the editor, and William Shawn took over. And William Shawn is really known, he was known to increase the length of the stories, the depth of the stories, the reporting. It was in the 1960s or so when, the Truman Capotes and Woody Allen even started, and Sylvia Plath was writing poetry in the late 1950s. That was all under William Shawn.
Mm. That's one of the issues that I want to go back to and read from the DVD. And also that 1936 profile of Adolf Hitler must be really interesting.
It's a three-part profile that Janet Flanner wrote in 1936. So, of course, your listeners would appreciate that. That's before the war, and to get a sense of the man that the world saw before the war is just fascinating.
Mm. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello. I just have a quick suggestion. I've seen several ads for this collection, and I don't know whether they were house ads in The New Yorker or in another magazine. But I think it would be a great idea when you advertise it that you say that it's completely indexed, so that, for example, if you want Cheever, Updike, or something, you can... you can get it, because the way it's it doesn't say that in the ads that I've seen. One just imagines having to wade through all that material, sort of in serial order or something. But if you advertise that it's completely indexed, I think that would tremendously raise the sale of it.
That's a great idea. I will raise that as soon as I'm off the air.
Sure.
Good idea.
Right.
Thanks for the call. And I don't know if the ads contain information on how you can sample it before you, if you're interested in buying it.
Yeah, that's another great idea.
Yeah. Who reads the magazine today? How has the readership changed over the years?
Well, one remarkable fact is that more readers, more people from the state of California read The New Yorker on a weekly basis than people from the state of New York, which surprised me. We're at just over a million subscribers at this point, which is more than we've ever had subscribing to this magazine. It's gotten to be kind of de rigueur, you know, a must read on a weekly basis for many, many people now. And that's largely a testament to our editor, David Remnick, and the amazing writers that he's got writing here and the editors.
Oh. It amazes me the journalism that the magazine can get to its readers, its subscribers, so quickly.
Yeah, well, we have, it's about 12 real pieces a week, and a relatively small staff that puts them together. It's a dash every week inside for those who are checking every fact and making sure that the copy is perfect and the writers out there, you know, pounding the pavement. It's an amazing machine, The New Yorker. The way it pumps out one wonderful piece after the next, and I have to say the mix, the decisions about how to balance one piece against the next each week is just a wonderful art form.
Yeah, the magazine, one of the magazines after the Hurricane Katrina, I believe it was the second week of September, and already we have a piece in there, a long, lengthy piece from John Lee Anderson about New Orleans.
Right. Yeah, we are. This is a reporting magazine. We're sending David Remnick dispatched John Lee Anderson, who, as I'm sure you all know, was in Afghanistan in the middle of the war there, and then in Iraq for months and months, reporting on the ground in Iraq, and there he was in the Gulf. He is an amazing reporter who will put himself into dangerous places and put his ear to the ground and get amazing stuff.
Yeah. Well, you've got to do the reporting. You've got to do the writing. Somebody's got to edit it. Then it's got to be, you know, printed.
That's right. When you're dealing with a 12,000-word or 15,000-word piece, you can't just phone it in. Quite literally.
Right.
There are those reporters who will do an 800 or 1,000-word piece who can literally get on the phone with their rewrite person back in New York and speak the story. But we are not equipped to do that in a situation where we've got real prose that we're writing for so many prose.
Yeah,
it's quite amazing. And when you look at this collection, the archive, you see that so many of these pieces hold up over time. It's not just that they were amazing then; they really stand the test of time.
Hmm. The experience of seeing all these past issues, what was the experience like for you? Were there surprises for you?
Well, first, yes, there were. One of the big surprises was how fascinating the ads were. Oftentimes, when I found that just flipping through magazines, I was looking more at the ads when I didn't have the opportunity to really sit down and read the piece. In the 1960s, you see the Jackie O influences and all of the ads. And as you move backwards, there are these funny ads about cigarette smoking and how good it is for you. And there's wonderful car ads. the big, beautiful cars, and it gives you such a great flavor of the culture of the time. And other surprises were that things like the Charles Addams cartoons. When Addams was developing the Addams Family in the magazine, these cartoons, which were so incredibly groundbreaking in retrospect, were dotted here and there through the magazine, almost so quietly. When you read them, you have a sense of what they are now, what the Addams Family is today. But then you can really understand stepping back and seeing it from the eyes of the readers at the time because of the way they're laid out. The other thing with the cartoons is that you appreciate, you know, the subtlety of the drawing in the old days. I mean, many times these were huge cartoons that took up the whole page, done in charcoal with lots of gray and shadowing. And it, the art of the cartoon was really focused on in the old days.
Hmm.
And other things are remarkable in their consistency. The talk of the town has really always been the same thing. The look, the feel of Talk of the Town, the kinds of stories that we run now and that were run in the old days are really the same. They're these small little jewels that keep everybody informed about what's happening. And that really hasn't changed over time.
Yeah. The look of the magazine, also constant.
The size of the magazine. One thing you don't quite get in this electronic version is that you don't get the sense of the size changes. The magazine was bigger in the old days. It was a longer piece of paper. It was almost like 8.5 by 14, like a legal size paper. So that felt different. And over time, slowly it got smaller until now, which I don't think it's going to get smaller. I think it'll stay the way it is. But otherwise, the typeface has always been really the same. It was invented for the magazine. It's called the New Yorker typeface, the Irvin typeface. Ray Irvin was the original designer of the magazine, and we call our typeface the Irvin typeface.
Mm. And Eustace Tilley.
And Eustace Still Tilley, who came along, he was the cover of the first issue, but then he became a real character. He became our mascot later on. And there were times through the history, if anybody has time to look through it, it's really fascinating because we did series of Eustace doing any number of things in the magazine. He became this real character.
Mm.
But that happened later.
Mm. Let's talk with another listener. Let's go to a caller in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. You just said that you didn't think that the size was going to change, but earlier you were referring to how much things had changed since the old days of microfilm to this new product. And I'm wondering if this perspective is always that we now think things are always going to stay the same, but we always realize they're different than they were before. I'm a librarian, and so I thought a lot about what you said about the microfilm. And I would hope you'll take a minute to comment on the possible perspective that someone could have that your writers who were complaining that they didn't think that they had given you the rights to, you know, electronic rights to make this product would sound very much the same as what you would say to an electronic librarian who would be making a product similar to yours without your permission and saying the same thing. This is
right.
The same as if we microfilmed it back in 1925.
Right. Well, okay. Thanks for your question. You raised a lot of issues. One is, will things ever change? Well, certainly. Every place is always reexamining the look and the feel of their product. There's no question about that. I was saying that the size of the magazine, the paper size, probably wouldn't get smaller, and I stick to that. But who knows? In terms of, you know, what contributors think about the use of this in an electronic format, it's a little different than the other issue you raised, which is very much the Google issue of the day. You know, can Google scan every book that's ever been published and put it into its search engine? Two very different activities.
with the New Yorker, we actually do own the copyright in the collective work. And with Google, they don't own any copyright to any work. They're saying, forget copyright, we're fair using the material in order to help people find what they're looking for and search through it. Microfilm is analogous to what we've done because it's taking the printed magazine and putting it into a new format, onto tape. And what the way you do that is you on film. I mean, so you take a photograph of every page and you put it on film, and you make it viewable through one of those enormous microfilm machines, and you print from the film, you know, through those machines. And that's really what we've done, except instead of putting it on film, we've put it on into a digital format. So the activity of a copyright holder like us versus a librarian or a Google is really very different.
Was a listener want to follow up? No, I think the listener is gone. Okay. Thanks for the call. Let's take another call. Listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Hello,
go ahead.
Yes, just a couple observations. One of them, you mentioned earlier on that Harold Ross, the founder of the magazine, retired or did something and William Shawn came in. Harold Ross actually died in office. He never did retire, at least to the best of my recollection. The other thing is, somewhere I read in one of the various histories of the New Yorker that it, although its early history was financially precarious, in the mid-30s, it suddenly achieved solvency, largely because of the influx of liquor advertising that happened after the repeal of Prohibition, which I thought was kind of funny. The other thing, just as a sidelight, I guess, is I'm going to look forward to looking into this collection and try to find if a cartoonist named A.A. Walgren, who was known as Wally, if any of his work ever appeared in the early issues of the magazine. I know that they never appeared in any reprints or anything like that. But Wally was the Bill Malden of World War One and worked on the Stars and Stripes, of which Harold Ross was managing editor. So I always wondered why there was why Wally never appeared in Harold Ross's magazine. I'll go away and hang up and let you comment. Thanks. Bye.
Thank you.
Okay.
Well, thanks for your comments, and I do recommend you look into the magazine and see if your cartoonist did appear. You'll be able to just put his name in to the artist search bar, and if he's there, he'll show up.
Interesting. And now let's go back to the librarian who called in and had the question about copyright. Let's go back to this gentleman, and he has a response.
Okay.
Line three, go ahead.
Sorry, I was trying to talk to you before, but I got lost.
Oh, okay.
As far as the compilation copyright mentioned, which is where I was trying to talk back, that can give you a copyright on the intellectual property of making the selection, but it can't give you a copyright in the individual work that was submitted. So I'm wondering how you think that applies to any rights that you might have to reprint, because it's not a copyright in the original article. It could obviously last longer than the copyright in the original article, but only as per your right to say, I created this collection of articles because it juxtaposed the proper opinions of this, that, and the other during World War II.
Yeah, actually, there's a little bit. I mean, this is getting really subtle copyright analysis, but the rights of a periodical, of a newspaper or magazine, or an encyclopedia are different than an anthology, which is just a collection of different articles or different pieces of one sort or another. The difference is that the Copyright Act specifically says that if you've got a periodical and you've put it into paper, you can
you have the privilege to basically revise that periodical any way you choose, as long as you keep it in this original context. Now, let me give you an example that is sometimes used, originally used. With an encyclopedia, for example, you get the right to print a piece about the Civil War, the U.S. Civil War, in your Encyclopedia Britannica. And then the Gulf War occurs many years later. And your Encyclopedia Britannica is being updated every year, and then you update it with the Gulf War or anything after the other entry. The Copyright Act says that you don't have to get permission to then change the encyclopedia each and every time and put it out. As long as you keep it basically the way it originally was and you add a little element here or there, like that fact that other things occurred and other little segments that you add into the encyclopedia. And in fact, it might go from one volume in the 1860s to many volumes in the 2000. But that's okay. That's really the same work, ultimately. You're exercising your rights under the Copyright Act to revise it a little bit, but you're not changing it. And that's really the same provision that gives newspapers and magazines the right to take their periodical and put it into any medium.
Am I still on here?
What's
yeah.
that?
Okay.
Yeah,
last time when I asked that, nothing happened. So, obviously, the copyright from 1860 is gone now.
Yes, yes.
Nothing
it's a bad
that was
example.
Written in 1860
it's a bad example.
Is copyrighted now.
Right.
But
1923 and
the Britannica gets a new copyright every single year. They'll put out a new one, and they'll claim a new copyright for that as per all the changes that they made. Now, I have to assume that it's up to the contract between them and their writers as to what kind of changes they can make.
No, it's not. It's not. They don't need to have a contract to be able to make those changes.
If I wrote something for Britannica,
yeah,
they could change my article.
Well, no, they would. Well, the changing of your article, I didn't say. I said they could leave your article, and they could add other articles in subsequent
right.
years.
I said change the article.
Yeah, that's. I wasn't saying that.
I think you're a lawyer, right?
Yes.
Okay, so you're trying to dodge the question.
No, I'm really not. I'm trying to answer your question as directly as I can.
All right.
And so I'm really happy to take as specific a question as you'd
like.
Well,
you have a collection of articles that dates back to 1925.
We have a magazine collection, yes.
And all of those 1925 articles, if renewed, would still be under copyright just by a couple of years as per our current Copyright Act of 1998.
Right. Yes, there's nothing at the New Yorker that's in the public domain.
Oh, I'm sure you published something that was published before 1923.
No, the New Yorker began in...
I'm sure you published something that was written before 1923. I've read the magazine.
Okay.
Have you?
Okay.
You know, when you start publishing in 1925, you're quoting things that were written before 1923.
Okay.
You know, not everything's written specifically for the magazine. So, but so again, we're getting off the point. The point would be... Those articles were written in 1925, were written before anybody thought about e-books. I'm sure you weren't thinking about e-books even 10 years ago.
Okay.
So you're saying that there's nothing required in the contract with the people who wrote those things in 1925 that would require you to get permission from them to use it again.
Right. That is correct.
Now... As long as it's this is a faithful reproduction of the 1925 magazine, as far as I can
tell. That's exactly why we can do it, yes.
So the idea that it's a faithful reproduction might be giving it a different context. But now, a library has a right to make faithful reproductions of things for their archives. And my original supposition that I tried to get in when you couldn't hear me, was that presuming there is such a thing as an electronic library, would they have the same rights to do with your product what any library does with microfilm from any other book from 1925 when they put it in their archives?
Libraries don't do microfilm.
They do.
They license
I'm sorry.
It's a company called... I mean, most microfilms are created by what was Bell & Howell and now is ProQuest. And that company will license from individual publishers like the New Yorker and say, can we put your magazine on microfilm? And then if we say yes, ProQuest will create the microfilm and then license it to the libraries. The libraries just are licensees.
Hmm. I wish what I could do is buy you and the caller a cup of coffee and get you, you know,
yeah,
sit you down in a room.
No, it's a fascinating discussion.
Because it is fascinating, and we are kind of out there in new territory, and it's very interesting, although as I think you mentioned, it's subtle and it's complicated. Here's a question from a layperson. Have you had any complaints, like from John Updike or J.D. Salinger?
No, actually, we haven't. In fact, our contributors so far are thrilled with it, and we have not had complaints.
Hmm. Very interesting. We're out of time.
Well,
sorry
thank you
to
for
say.
Having me, Celeste.
Oh, my pleasure. Ed Claris has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the general counsel for the New Yorker magazine, and he is the project director for the DVD collection, The Complete New Yorker. It is 1:52. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade, after a surprising number for the beans this morning, USDA releasing a number at 2.96 billion bushels for the soybean crop across the nation. That compares to the trade expected 3 billion, 0.006, actually. And while it doesn't sound too much difference, there's about a 900,000-acre loss in there as well. And the trade looking at all of it and saying, hey, we may have the beans way too low. There was some rally early today that ran up 8.15, and by the end of the day, 25.5 cents. If you're thinking about LDP in Illinois, Indiana, and Iowa, in fact, there is a soybean LDP at 7 cents for the day. So there's an opportunity that may be available as of yet. We'll talk to Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services out of Oakland, Illinois, to see what he thinks about this marketplace and the LDP for the soybeans a little bit later in the afternoon at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock during the closing market report. We'll also talk with Joe Persaki, who is the chief of the crops branch at USDA NASS. We'll ask him just what happened to those 900,000 acres of soybeans that disappeared between the June 30th acreage report and today's report. Now, from the Chicago Board of Trade, December wheat had a high today of 350, a low at 344.5, settlement price there at 347.5. Pretty good report for the wheat as well this morning. We'll talk about that during the closing market report. Up 4.75 cents for the December contract. March futures at 364 on the high, the low at 358.5, settled at 361.5. They were up 3.75. May soybeans 371, the high, the low at 366.5, settled 369. They were up a nickel for the day. And July futures at 376.5 on the high, the low at 371. Settlement price at 374.5, up 3.75. September futures in the wheat pit 382, the high, the low at 378. Settlement price at 380.5. They were up 3.5. Corn pit up by any player between 2 and 3 cents today. LDP at 45 cents in Champaign County. December contract 207.5, the high, the low at 203.75 in the Dease corn. Your harvest month settled at 205.75. They were up 3.25. March contract at 220.25 high, low at 216.75. Settlement price there at $2.18. They were up 2.75 in the May. Soybeans 227.75 on the high, rather corn. The low at 224.5 and a settlement price at 226 for that May corn contract. Up 2.75. July futures 234.5 the high, the low at 231.25. Settlement price at 233. They were up 2.75 in the September futures. 241 the high, the low at 238. Settlement price at 239.75, up 3.75. And December futures 250 the high, the low at 247. Settlement price at 248.75. They were up 2.75. By the way, trade got very close on the expectations for the corn production number at 10.862 billion on their estimate this morning. The actual corn number from USDA, a total harvest of 10.857 billion bushels. December oats 172.5, the high, the low at 165. Settlement price at 170.75. They were up 5.25 in the March at 177 high, low at 173.25. Settlement price there at 176.75. They were up 4.25. November beans now, $5.94 the high for the day, low at 576.5. Settlement price at 589. They were up 25.5 cents on the day. January futures $6.06 for the high, the low at 588. settled above $6 at 6.01. They were up 24.5 in the March futures. 6.14 the high. The low at 5.96, settled 6.06.5, up 23.5. May contract 6.17 the high. The low at $6.05. Settlement price at 6.12, up 23.5. And July futures 6.21 the high. The low at 6.06. Settlement price 4 cents off the high at $6.17. They were still up 23.5 for the day. In the August, up 21.5. They had a high of 6.20, a low at 6.08, and a settlement price at $6.15. October bean meal 173.50 the high. The low at 167.30. Settlement price at 173.20. They were up 8.10. And December futures 177 the high. Low at 170 even, a settlement price there for the December meal at $175.90. They were up 8 for the day. October bean oil, $24.25 the high, the low at $23.85. Settlement price at $24.10, up 70 cents. And December bean oil, $24.51 the high, the low at $24 even. Settled at $24.19. They were up 61 for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. It was a lower day today on the Mercantile Exchange for feeder cattle, live cattle, lean hogs, and February pork bellies. I'll have the specifics in just a second.
Agricultural information on AM 580 is made possible with support from Lincoln Land Agri Energy in Palestine, Illinois. Deferred pricing contracts available this fall. More information at 800-586-2321 or online at lincolnlandenergy.com.
And let's take a look now at the numbers. Feeder cattle, October feeders, 118.72.5. The high, the low, 118.15. The settlement, 118.57.5. That down 12.5. November, 117.30. The high, the low, 116.55. The settlement, 116.82.5. That finishing down 17.5. January feeder cattle, 114.25. The high, the low, 113.70. The settlement, 113.97.5. The change there, down 20. October live cattle, 91.10. The high, 90.47.5. The low, 90.77.5. The settlement, that unchanged. December, 91.60. The high, 90.95. The low, 91.20. The settlement, that down 17.5. October lean hog, 67.57.5. The high, 67.10. The low, the settlement, 67.27.5. That down 40. December, 63.65. The high, 62.25. The low, 62.37.5. The settlement, that down 112.5. February, 66.47.5. The high, 65.20. The low, 65.40. The settlement, that down 137.5. April lean hog, 65.55. The high, 64.45. The low, 65.05. The settlement, that down 70. February bellies, 95.50. The high, 92.12.5. The low, 92.37.5. The settlement, that down 222